The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have two presentations today on sex trafficking in Minnesota and an update on the Safe Harbor Act of 2011. We also have a bill that we will take up now that Representative Hillstrom. So if you're ready, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 90 be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee.
Very good. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to introduce your bill and have your witnesses testify?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this bill was brought to me by the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project, and I'm just going to have them start and say who they are and then what the bill will quickly do. So, Iris Freeman.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Chairman, and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. I am a social worker by background, and I've worked in vulnerable adult casework and policy for 35 years. One of my duties at school is coordinating the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which is a collaborative forum of law enforcement, healthcare, county attorneys, county adult protective services workers, seniors advocates, disability advocates, and others, all with an interest in the protection of vulnerable adults. And we meet on a regular basis to look at systems, to look at best practices in our work, and to share those. Part of our work is to look for areas that need fixing. And to that degree, we have working groups, including one on the criminal code, that examine practice and policy and try to bring the two in into the best possible match. The issues that we have dealt with a great deal in the last several years have to do with financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. And you know just from the headlines what a growing and pervasive problem that is. This bill is a product of that process and focused on that issue, and Mary Lynch, Assistant County Attorney in Hennepin County, will talk to you about the substance of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Ms. Lynch, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you. My name is Mary Lynch. As Ms. Freeman said, I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm here today speaking as a member of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which the county attorney's office is also a part of. I am strongly, as a prosecutor's involved in financial exploitation cases involving vulnerable adults, strongly supportive, both as an individual prosecutor and as a member of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, of both of these proposals. The aggregation proportion of the bill is the first section. That is really a clarification. It's to help align the financial exploitation statutes with the other theft statutes that allow aggregation of certain types of offenses over time and over counties. The 2009 Vulnerable Adult Act allowed a new offense of offenses over $35,000 to be financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. This has been an important tool in the local prosecutor's kit in terms of deciding how to address these cases. Frequently, these cases are aggregated either within financial exploitation or within related theft statutes, but this proposal would place the aggregation language as part of the financial exploitation statute, make it very clear to prosecutors, some of whom will only deal with a small number of these cases over time, but make it very clear that aggregation is available and will lead to more effective prosecutions as a result. We literally see a number of cases where the loss to the victims and the victim's family and the care facilities are well over $100,000, and without the ability to aggregate, we may be only able to charge one count of financial exploitation, but with the ability to aggregate, we can charge two or three or sometimes more counts, which more accurately reflects the seriousness of the behavior and allows a varied and appropriate response by the prosecutor. And again, I would emphasize that we see this as really a refinement and a clarification and to make sure that practice throughout the state is consistent and so that both prosecutors and the families, victims, and defendants are getting a fair and equal treatment. The venue provision is a change in the statute and would be an expansion of venue. This is in response to a phenomena that prosecutors as well as investigators have observed in financial exploitation cases where the harm is often felt in a different place or different jurisdiction. As I'm sure the committee is aware, venue is restricted typically to where offenses occurred. In financial cases, that means where individual transactions occurred. However, the victim in vulnerable adult cases is frequently living and perhaps living at the time of an investigation or at the time the harm comes to light in a county other than where the transactions happen. Sometimes that's as simple as the victim is now living, for example, in Dakota County. The victim's bank accounts are in Hennepin County. And the victim's family members who are conducting the financial exploitation are living in Hennepin County. So the transactions happen there. That may be an appropriate place to prosecute. That may not be an appropriate place to prosecute, in part because investigations frequently happen where the victim lives. And that is a byproduct of the civil process, which works very well, the adult protection process, which investigates first where the victim lives. So the venue provision is really to provide prosecutors and investigators appropriate set of tools to address the prosecution and the investigation where the harm happens and to better align with the civil process. And I think just it's also just a reality. These are complicated cases for local law enforcement agencies to investigate and work up. Over time, investigators and prosecutors get to know each other, are able to provide good feedback, and be helpful in terms of both conducting a good investigation and then a good prosecution. These cases frequently change over the course of the actual court time of the prosecution as well as the investigation. And then the reality of just where are the witnesses. In financial cases, that's frequently a challenge. Getting the witnesses together and having the most appropriate response and ability to conduct the court case is a real important piece. Venue would allow us to choose the place of prosecution that works the best. The inspiration for this statute at the Vulnerable Adult Project was, Justice Project, was the identity theft statute, which has a very similar provision. It's basically, it just reflects the reality that victims and transactions often don't happen in the same geographical place, but we want to make sure we can address the issues.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm still in the last meeting. I just wondered, knowing that defense attorneys are pretty ingenious and actually read the language, if you're trying to aggregate what you're trying to do in this bill, then wouldn't you want in the last line in 121 something like of the victim or one of the victims, because you're, if you just have the victim, I can see a good argument that you couldn't bring the aggregation in. So I'm just trying to protect what you seem to be trying to do.
Ms. Lynch.
Thank you. Excuse me. I think that that is a good point. I think, however, the aggregation speaks to the transactions rather than the victims, and I think that we're usually able to, since this language is very similar to the standard theft statute aggregations, we're usually able to make that distinction and make the argument successfully in local courts. So you can combine victims, but you can also, the aggregation statute really speaks to the individual transactions or acts of the defendant.
Oh, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm suggesting is, it seems to me that the it doesn't say on aggregation that it has to be just one victim, and I thought that part of this was to try and get at people who do it to more than one victim, that you could aggregate these offenses. And so if that, if you just leave in the word the victim, I think it creates an ambiguity as to whether you can lump in offenses against more than one person.
Ms. Lynch.
Thank you. Just for clarification, Representative, are you speaking of the Section 2, speaking to the Subdivision 5 part of the statute, the county or resident of the victim or victims?
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Mullery. I think you said yes.
Thank you. I don't think that that would be a harmful clarification then in that sense.
I think somebody else than me, like our staff, should get the exact language.
Can we clean that or fix that if that's okay with you, Representative Hillstrom, at the next stop? Or do you want to do that here?
No, I think that's it's pretty clear what the committee wants, and I think that that's a proper change. Mr. Chair, happy to change it in the next committee.
Okay. Representative Mueller, anything else?
Mr. Chairman, I think Ms. Perius.
Ms. Perius, you want to, should we do this now, or do we want to wait till the next stop? We can fix it now.
This is fine.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be to House File 90, page 1, line 21. Before the period, insert "or one of the victims."
Thanks. Mr. Chair?
On line 1.21?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom?
I have no objection to that, Mr. Chair.
Can we just incorporate that? Is that, we'll just incorporate that? I don't think we need to vote on it, do we?
I think we don't have an amendment, so I don't think there's anything to incorporate it into, so I think we just have to vote to
amend. Okay. Representative Kelly had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom made just a clarification. Are we trying to aggregate crimes against one individual or aggregating crimes against more than one? I guess that's, I think, this is where we're getting a little confused. I thought it was against one individual over a set period of time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you do have the ability to aggravate, aggregate. You do have the ability to aggregate over multiple victims, of course, if it happens all in the exact same place anyways, like the theft statute. So this would then say that you can aggregate more than one victim and more than one location that they're, or more than one county that they're taking, and just clarify. I think you already can do that. We just want to make it very clear to all of our partners across the state that this is what the legislature intended.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on this? So the amendment would be from Representative Mullery on line 1.21, delete the period and insert comma or one of the victims, period. Is that correct? Is there any discussion on that amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. That motion prevails. Now we have the amended bill of Representative Hillstrom. Do you have anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor. Or I'm sorry.
No, not that. Okay, so do you want to renew your motion, please?
Mr. Chair, did you want to see if anyone in the audience wanted to?
Oh, testify? Yes, probably a good idea. Does anyone want to testify for or against the bill? Nobody wants to testify, Representative Hillstrom.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would renew my motion that House File 90 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Judiciary, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom is moving that House File 90 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. 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 All those opposed, that motion prevails. Thank you to the witnesses, Representative Hillstrom. Just a couple of announcements. We have the BCA tour is scheduled for February 19th, and the tour of Oak Park Heights and the Stillwater Prisons are tentatively scheduled. It's confirmed on Friday, March the 8th. So if we need, we'll obviously need transportation to the prisons, but if we want to just meet at the BCA, we could probably do that. Then we need approval. I need a motion to approve the minutes of Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the minutes say a quorum was not present at the bottom, and I think that's a mistake.
It wasn't present at the time, but then it was present at 10:07.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You
good catch, though.
Way?
Yeah. No, I mean, it wasn't present. When we convened, it was not present. I'm not sure we need to do that in the future, but unless you would like to have that language.
It's up to you. I just wanted to make sure.
In the future, we won't do that. We started the meeting. There was not a quorum, and there was a quorum present at 10:07.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I do need a motion to approve them. Okay. That motion has been made. Is there any by Representative Schoen? Any discussion in the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now we'll go to our two presentations today. Pleased that the Ramsey County Attorney John Choi is here to talk about sex trafficking, and you have some witnesses with you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. First, I want to begin by thanking you, Mr. Chair, and the members for taking really valuable committee time to focus on what I believe to be a very important issue in the state of Minnesota. And so it's an honor for me to be a part of your legislative process as we think about how we can, as a community, end sex trafficking in our state. My task here today is to try to help define this problem. And as the chief prosecutor, one of the things that I've come to realize is that throughout the day-to-day work that I do, I see a lot of the things, the details of what's happening. And so when I'm talking to other people out in our community, I think there's sometimes a disconnect about the things that I know about just the horrific things that are happening to our children around the issue of commercial sexual exploitation and making sure that the public understands all that. And so I'm really happy to be here and to really share with you some of the things that I think that the public needs to know and that all of you as lawmakers need to know about what is happening in our communities. You know, there was a study that was recently conducted, and it was conducted in November of 2010, and this was done pretty conservatively, but on any given weekend night in our state, 45 girls under the age of 18 are sold for sex through the internet or the classified websites, most notably on sites like Backpage.com. The average age of entry into prostitution is 13 years of age. I'm going to repeat that. 13 years of age is when a girl is first prostituted in the state of Minnesota. The FBI has identified the Twin Cities region as one of the 13th largest center for child prostitution in America. I really believe this is one of the greatest tragedies, human rights tragedies of our time, and it's happening right before our eyes and in our communities. And when I speak of communities, let us make no mistake, I'm talking about the entire state of Minnesota. Last year in Ramsey County, we prosecuted 12 defendants for sex, the trafficking of children. Those victims come from all over the state of Minnesota. In fact, almost half of those victims are from greater Minnesota. And one was from Des Moines, Iowa. There's an important connection with respect to these young girls who are finding themselves in these situations. The bottom line is that they're all vulnerable and they're all runaways. They run away from home. And so when you're in that situation, you're in an incredibly vulnerable state, and there are really bad people out there who are looking to basically recruit these girls and then sell them on the internet and to most of the time men in our community. In fact, there's a well-known statistic that 40% of all runaway children are sexually exploited at some time. And again, I want to just reiterate that the victims that I deal with, they are come from all backgrounds, all races, all socioeconomic backgrounds. And that common thread, again, is that they're incredibly vulnerable, and many of them, at least in my jurisdiction, they've run away from home, whether they came from southwestern Minnesota or Duluth or Des Moines, Iowa. They find themselves in my community in Ramsey County, and they are trafficked on the internet, and then they're sold to men in our community. Oftentimes, these victims are going to be threatened with violence, and actual acts of violence are done onto them. Their families are threatened. In fact, the average life expectancy of a juvenile once she or he starts being trafficked is 7 years. In fact, they are four times more likely to be a victim of murder. Victims are seen as nothing more than a product. And I see this criminal enterprise moving in this particular direction, because if you think about it, if you're dealing drugs, you can only use that one time. But when you've got a human being and you're trafficking them on the internet, you can reuse that victim over and over again. In fact, the Polaris Project conservatively estimates that a pimp with a stable of three victims with an average quota of $500 per victim can make over $500,000 a year. And we're seeing this play out across the country. In fact, I was just at a conference in Washington, D.C., but the criminal enterprises in some other areas, like in Virginia, it's even grown more rampant. And so this problem is facing our community. It's right before our eyes, and it's hurting our children, the children of our state. I want to play a 911 audio tape, and it's pretty intense, and I apologize for that, but I think it's very critical that this committee understands that what we're dealing with and the gravity of harm that is caused. And so we're going to, it's about a 3-minute clip, but I think it gives you a very good introduction of the things that we have to deal with at the end of the criminal justice system when we're prosecuting traffickers. But let me introduce this tape by telling you that this girl was 17 years of age. She was from Des Moines, Iowa. And she turned and she came here to the Twin Cities on a bus. And she got here on a bus because she was running away from home, and a man from our community convinced her to run away. He arranged her to have sex with one of his friends in Des Moines, Iowa, and that paid for her bus ticket up here. And then when she got here, she was here in our community for 7 days, and her 7 days was a complete hell. In fact, during that time period, she turned 18 years of age. During that time, she was forced to have sex with 30 men from our community. And so we'll play the tape here.
911, where's your emergency?
This is fine. I'm a runaway from Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm in big trouble. I know. I'm afraid I'm about to get killed.
All right, honey, I'm going to help you, okay? Are you at the Hilton Garden Inn right now?
Yes.
How old are you, honey?
I just turned 18. The people who are wanting to hurt me are just left.
What, not your bus?
No, I'm in the hotel room.
Which hotel room are you in, Barb?
On 4-8 and on room 851.
851, did they just leave?
Yeah, but I'm afraid they're going to come back.
I'm going to help you right now. You're going to stay on the phone with me, and I will not hang up with you, okay? You promise me?
Yes.
Good girl. Now, who are those people? Do you know their names?
Yeah, one's name is Tyree Eric Jones, and the other one's, I don't know her last name, but her name's Bianca.
What's going on with them?
Well, they touched me in the coming here, so I ran away from home.
Mm-hmm.
In the last couple of days, they've been threatening me and saying that I owe them money, and if I don't give them their money, they're going to kill me. I hide appearances under my pillow because I'm afraid that I need to defend myself. I don't want to be in the
anymore. Honey, I'm going to help you, okay? I promise. No, I'm sending somebody there to come help you right now. Now, the guy named Tyree, is he black?
Yes, Tyree Eric Jones is his name.
Tyree Eric Jones. Now, how old is Tyree, do you think?
He's 18.
18? Is he from Iowa, like you?
I think so, but he has family here in Minnesota.
All right. And what is the, girl white, black, Mexican, Asian?
The girl's black.
Black female, what's her name?
Bianca.
And how old is Bianca, do you think?
I think she said she was 23.
23? What's Bianca's last name?
I think it's Nicole or something, but she said she has a warrant here in Minnesota.
Des Moines, Iowa? To come to Minnesota for what? Did they ever tell you?
They told me I was supposed to make money, and they've been making me see my guys, and now I'm afraid I have something.
That's all right, honey. I'm going to send you a doctor, too, okay?
Okay.
When does it start, sweetie?
I don't... It's Thursday. I came here last week on Wednesday.
Now, is there anything I should know about aside from what you've told me, sweetie? Is there any weapons in the room? Any drugs?
Like I said, I had a pair of scissors under my pillow because I'm afraid they're going to hurt me.
What do you have under your pillow, honey?
A pair of sharp scissors.
All right. Well, the officers, the next knock you hear at your door will be the officers, and I'm going to stay on the phone with you the whole time, okay?
Okay.
Well, clearly, this girl, a 17-year-old girl who turned 18, is clearly a victim of crime, and she is not a criminal or a delinquent, and I really believe that the first step in ending sex trafficking is to develop a victim-centered approach that appropriately looks at this girl and says that we need to help her, intervene in her life, and get her into a safe place, and then deal with the reasons why she's running away. You know, in February of 2011, prosecutors in the 7-county metro area, including Olmsted County and St. Louis County, made a very important step, which was to say that we publicly that we would no longer prosecute girls and start looking at these children as children in need of protection and victims of crime. And then later that year, the Minnesota legislature and Governor Dayton enacted the Safe Harbor Law, which is very important, which basically codifies that value and that principle. And having that victim-centered approach is so important because to prosecute and hold accountable those traffickers is very, very difficult because oftentimes the victim in these cases believes that they're in love with the trafficker, or may not want to participate for a whole host of reasons in holding that trafficker accountable, whether it's based upon coercion or threats of violence against them or their family, or just because of the place that they are in their life. And one of the things that I really believe in order for us to make a difference is to have that victim-centered approach where we have services, where we have interventions, and we have shelter space available so that we can get these children to a safe place and away from the people, the bad people that are making the bad things happen to this, to these victims. And I really believe since February of 2011, we are making a real big difference in adopting this victim-centered approach. In fact, just recently we had a case involving a man named Samuel Cozart. He was trafficking a 17-year-old girl from southwestern Minnesota at the Days Inn in Roseville. And because of a hotel employee, a conscientious hotel employee who called the police were able to come to the situation and just ask some questions. And they decided to separate the 17-year-old and the alleged trafficker, and for an hour, the 17-year-old girl would not talk. But for an hour, the Roseville police officer reiterated the fact that she was not in trouble, that she was there to help her. And she kept repeating that. And then after about an hour, she broke down in tears and said, I do need some help. I want to get out of this situation. And from there, a very positive relationship was developed between that police department and this girl. And then by the time that we got to trial, this amazing 17-year-old girl was ready, willing, and able to testify against that trafficker. The case resolved on the first day of trial because the trafficker realized what he was in for, and so he pled guilty, and he received a sentence of 21 years in prison, which is, from what I understand, to be the longest prison sentence for sex trafficking in the state of Minnesota. But that girl would not have testified if we did not have that victim-centered approach in terms of what we do with respect to law enforcement, what we do with respect to prosecution. And today, you're going to hear from other people who are going to be talking about the Safe Harbors Law that was passed in 2011 and what it contemplated, which was to develop a victim-centered approach and then to develop and figure out a way to fund the services and the intervention and the training and the protocol development that we need to have in systems to change the way that we go about looking at these cases. In the criminal justice system and law enforcement, we're very situation-based, incident-based, so when we have a runaway, the goal is to find the runaway and perhaps get them home. but there needs to be some other things that we need to do from a law enforcement perspective, I think, to do a better job around these issues. And then also, when you have a child who is being trafficked at 2 a.m., law enforcement across the state needs a place to take these victims. And then what we need to do is start working on intervention services and working on those issues to help keep the victim safe, and then also helping them with the issues that they're dealing with. And when we make those investments, and just as an example, the Runaway Intervention Program in Ramsey County is the only program that is dealing with runaway kids and sex trafficked kids, where the federal government has said that this program is worthy of being replicated because the evidence and the data is so compelling. We have the funding in Ramsey County through foundations to serve 75 girls who have been sexually exploited at least two times. And if you wonder why they have to be exploited at least two times, the sad reality is we don't have the resources to fund all of the kids. So there are 75 kids who have been sexually exploited at least two times, and when they're, and it's a public health intervention model where there's a public health nurse dealing in a very intensive way with the victim. But after a year in the Runaway Intervention Program, this population, and this has been studied since its inception in 2005, so every year we do data analysis, but on three factors, on pregnancy, suicidal thoughts, and incidents of self-harm, this population that's been sexually exploited two or more times does better than the Minnesota Student Survey, the average score for that age group. So in other words, girls that are going, who've had this traumatic experience, who go through this intensive experience, get on the right track in life. And it's an evidence-based approach. And that investment that we make, it returns $34 for every dollar that we spend, according to the Minnesota Indians Resource Center at the University of Minnesota that just recently conducted a study. And I know Michelle will be talking about that. So we've got a big problem here in the state of Minnesota. And in order for us to really have this victim-centered approach, what we really need to do is to enact what was contemplated in 2011, which was the No Wrong Door model, to help fund this intervention and the services that are necessary. And I know that if we do, we can make a difference. And I think another important part of that is the training piece with respect to law enforcement. We just recently conducted the first year of a grant for the Minnesota Women's Foundation, and we are looking backwards in time and looking at some of those runaway cases to try to figure out where the gaps might be with respect to the law enforcement response. And a lot of credit should be given to Chief Smith, who has been very open about going through this review, because you know, when someone is looking through your files in an agency, you know, that can also always be a scary thing, but it was necessary for us to make sure that we develop the best possible response around this issue. In a lot of ways, the issue of sex trafficking is a lot like domestic violence back in the 1950s and 1960s. Since that time, so many things have changed, and a lot of that, the Duluth model, Representative Paymar, you were very involved with that, but about this concept of providing those services for domestic violence victims. Now we have shelters throughout the state. We have services. We have victim advocates who are focused around domestic violence. And then we also have different approaches from law enforcement. Law enforcement no longer says, well, this must be a family matter. They'll resolve it. It's actually a criminal matter. And people are taken into custody, and we try to get charges as quickly as possible so that we can save lives. And today, from a prosecution standpoint, even if the victim doesn't participate, which is usually your star witness, we will proceed with a prosecution. So much has changed. And we are today, with respect to sex trafficking, how we were with domestic violence in the 1960s. And so I'm here today to end sex trafficking. I'm asking all of you to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you, County Attorney Choi. Any questions at this point? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one. I see that in the omnibus bill we did the Safe Harbor Act in 2011, and it says it increases fines on the Johns. I'm wondering if the fines go to help support these shelters that we're talking about.
County Attorney Choi, it looks like it does on page 2 of the handout here, but why don't you explain that a little bit more, page 3, I guess.
Yeah, that provision, I think that's what was contemplated in the law to do that, and I'm not sure how the actual effective date is 2014 for that provision, so that's a part of what we're looking at. I don't know if the department wants to address that issue.
Mr. Chair?
Does someone have the answer to that?
Okay, go. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Can you introduce yourself for the record so we know?
I will. Thank you. I'm Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I'm at the Advocates for Human Rights. And I was looking back behind me because a person from the Department of Public Safety is here who administers the fund and could actually tell us how much money is in there. But that did, the penalty assessment against Johns, against commercial sexual abusers, was increased. There was a minimum set under the 2011 law. And then that allocation was split, I believe, thank you, we're having an issue, was split 40% to law enforcement, 40% to the courts, and the balance to victim services. And that, I think we have begun to collect money on that and put that into a fund, and Ms. Piskova could probably give us the precise number, but I think it's around
$5,000.
$7,000 right now. I should be clear that the fines or the penalty assessment was against Johns in prostitution cases involving adult women.
Representative Kiefer.
Yes, thank you. Just so I'm looking at a number, maximum $750. Is that correct?
Ms. Garnett McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct because this is the misdemeanor level prosecution for an adult man or woman purchasing an adult man or woman.
And
prostitution.
The trafficking penalties are actually significantly higher, and they're felonies, are they?
Correct. If they involve the child.
Yes. Representative Kiefer.
No, that's it. Thank you.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Isn't it true, and what I've read, and I don't know the percentage, and maybe you do, that kids, girls who are on the run, that run away, are commonly running from some sexual abuse at home within their extended family or neighborhood, and that that's often the cause for them to run and then become victimized in this trafficking? And is there any program then that reaches into that population before they are on the run?
County Attorney Choi.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum, I think there are very much instances where kids are running from sexual abuse. I don't have a statistic for you, but certainly that happens. And I think one of the important parts of all of this, and as part of the safe harbor law that all of you passed in 2011, is that that runaway child is in need of protection. And so what the law contemplates is that that child would be dealt with through our child protection system. And so the vision there would be that those issues would be addressed with respect to any type of abuse that's happening at home through the child protection system.
Representative Slocum, anything else? Okay. Okay. Representative Simon?
Yeah. County Attorney Choi, welcome, and or to anyone who wants to answer this question. I, this summer, met with a mutual friend of ours who's now on the Ramsey County bench and is in the juvenile block, and I said, so what can we do that we're not doing at the legislature? And he, without hesitation, he said, I have one recommendation, and that is we need secure housing for runaway youth. Instantly, first thing out of his mouth, he said, it's imperative, we have to have it, not just sexually exploited youth, but youth in general who are runaways. I know that is sort of pegged to the recommendation number 8 in the report here, but what do you think we can and should do going forward? I know what the recommendations were here, and it focused on sexually exploited youth, but what can and should we do in that area? Secure housing for runaway youth so they aren't either sent back home to a dysfunctional, violent, terrible situation, which is sometimes the case, but they're not also loose where they can be exploited sexually or otherwise.
County Attorney Choi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that issue of secure placement is incredibly important because as we transition, you know, the metro counties have already started this transition, but in 2014 when this law goes into effect, the option of detention for the purpose of holding somebody for their safety is really not going to be an option. And so what we really need to do is to develop a place where we can have secure placement in housing. And so that is the most important issue that's lacking, I believe, because at 2 o'clock in the morning, in the short term, a police officer really doesn't have a particular place to take somebody. And then secondly, what we find is in many of the shelters that aren't dealing with some of the kids that are wanting to run, that as soon as they check into a facility, they're out the door the next day, and oftentimes they're going right back to the people that are victimizing them. And so we need to figure out ways to think outside the box to keep kids for their own safety, one of which I believe I'm a strong proponent of is geographic separation. For instance, in Benson, Minnesota, there's the Girls Ranch does a really wonderful job with runaway girls and exploited girls. And by being in Benson, that distance really helps with respect to helping these children.
Representative Simon.
Quick follow-up. I know that there's going to be, as there has been in the past, the Runaway Homeless Youth Act and other attempts to get the funding. According to the report here I see starting on page 19, it sort of breaks down what the cost might be. I think it's $8 or $9 million, something like that. But are you saying, County Attorney Choi, that you think this should be multiple locations, it should be dispersed, or do you have an opinion on if we were able to raise and get that money, first of all, whether that's adequate, second of all, how we should do that housing piece? In other words, to make sure that the cop at 2 in the morning can bring the kid somewhere.
County Attorney Choi.
Yeah, I mean, if the question is, if you're asking me if it's needed, the absolute answer is yes, because we've got runaway cases all across the state. And if the statistics tell you that 30 to 40% of these children are being sexually exploited, we need to do more. And so, and again, the victims that we're getting are from all over the state. They're not just kids from St. Paul or Minneapolis. They're, in fact, the most recent case that we have are two young teens from Duluth. And so I think the issue of trying to have a safe place, a shelter space for kids that are running homeless is an important issue.
Representative Leshen, were you two going to present? Okay, so we should probably, after Representative Lesh asks this question, hear the rest of the presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Choi, thank you for this. I remember when you and I first talked about this years ago, about the direction of what needs to happen and a different philosophy with respect to prosecutors on this. And it was, I think, just last fall that I was on a sting with the St. Paul Vice Unit and was struck, as I usually am when I prosecute these, of the number of dentists, software engineers, ministers from the community who drive in to St. Paul over the noon hour, and the female police officers who I was watching in the room at the time, and I've only done maybe about four or five of these ride-alongs, but phones ringing off the hook constantly based on the ads. And it reminded me of the opening line of that old radio program, "Who Knows What Evil Lurks in the Hearts of Men." There are a lot of people out there, and it is constant. And despite the fact that it's called the world's oldest profession, there seems to be an inability for society to distinguish between crimes like these committed against adult women and crimes committed against children. And because they're both illegal, there is a tendency of those to blend together, and the effect is netting a lot of young runaway children into the system. Do you see, and is there any evidence to suggest, that because both are criminalized in the state of Minnesota, adult and adult prostitution and child trafficking, that we have a more difficulty netting criminals who traffic children. And I'm not sure if that's clear, but do they have more success regulating the heck out of adult prostitution in Nevada, for example, and thereby diminishing impacts on children in that state? Have you seen any evidence to that effect?
County Attorney Choi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I haven't seen any evidence to that issue. If you're suggesting that we should legalize prostitution, it wouldn't be for that. Because at the end of the day, I think it's this commercial enterprise, whether it's illegal as it is here in the state of Minnesota or legal, I guess, in Nevada, the bottom line is that the whole issue is there are victims involved. These are not choices, in my opinion, that people are making. And what I see, and it's not the pretty woman scenario in the movies that sometimes Hollywood portrays it to be. It's entirely different. It involves people that are vulnerable, and the situations that I see in a growing rate are situations involving our children.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
just
Lesh.
To be clear, Ms. Choi, I'm not suggesting that. And even at the beginning of Pretty Woman, you may remember that her roommate stole their rent money to buy drugs.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not a Cinderella story as they portray it in the end. But what I'm trying to get across is that these ventures are successful because they rely upon the shadows. They rely on the fact that people don't talk about it. They rely on the fact that your neighbor out in whatever bedroom community of St. Paul or Minneapolis does this every other week, drives into the city and pays for sex. And you never know about it. And they're always successful because they never get caught because we don't have enough money for vice details to reduce the activity in St. Paul. And part of this is, are there other methods to shine the light in on this activity because it thrives in the shadows?
And I think a big part of that is
community
engagement and getting our community involved. And a part of that, too, is how we raise our boys. You know, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, that's that 17-year-old girl was forced to have sex with 30 men in our community. And how are we raising those men? Those, at one time, they were boys. And in a lot of ways, people have said that on Backpage.com, ordering another human being for sexual purposes is as easy as ordering a pizza. And so that, I think there's a lot of things that needs to change, and a part of that is that the law enforcement and prosecution can't solve this problem alone. It has to involve the public value and ensuring that we're developing good values within our families and within our communities, and a big part of that is, I believe, how men look at this issue.
Okay, with that, thank you. So let's hear the other two presentations. I don't know who wants to go first, but
I think I'm up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Again, my name's Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I'm Director of Advocacy at the Advocates for Human Rights. We're a nonprofit, non-governmental organization based here in Minnesota. I add my thanks to you and to the committee for taking this time to hear about what, in our opinion, is one of the most troubling human rights abuses that takes place in our community every day, the sex trafficking of children. I know the governor declared this week Sex Trafficking Prevention Week, and it's very timely to have this hearing here today in that spirit. I'm pleased to be with you this morning to talk about the Safe Harbors Law, to kind of bring us up to date on what has happened to this point and what's needed to move us forward and addressing an effective implementation of that act that many members on this committee were instrumental in bringing about. My colleague Jeff Bauer from the Family Partnership is going to be addressing some of the specific recommendations in that No Wrong Door report that you have received already. As we've already heard, human trafficking is a form of slavery. It's involuntary servitude, and it results in grave human rights violations. At heart, it really involves individuals profiting from the sexual exploitation of other people. And too often it results in brutal physical and sexual assaults, in devastating physical and psychological injuries, and in that life expectancy that County Attorney Choi referenced, 7 years of survival. And tragically, sex trafficking of children in Minnesota is really all too common. As you've heard from County Attorney Choi, it's a violent, predatory crime. Traffickers seek out persons they believe and perceive to be vulnerable, including the young. The average age of entry into prostitution, you've heard, that's sixth and seventh grade. And those kids are used until they're used up. The Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Act of 2011 really changed Minnesota's approach to meeting the needs of sexually exploited youth and youth at risk of sexual exploitation, going back beyond just those who are victims into the prevention of that crime. Safe Harbor defined prostituted children as the victims of sexual exploitation for the first time. You expanded that definition, ended reliance on the delinquency proceedings as the sole system's response to meeting the needs of these crime victims, and called for the creation of a framework for the state of Minnesota to implement these changes, which will become effective in August of 2014. Safe Harbor builds on our unique history of confronting commercial sexual exploitation, including sex trafficking, through grassroots activism, through service provision, fantastic law enforcement, and innovative legal reform. With the passage of 2005's anti-trafficking law, the legislature here recognized that we need to hold perpetrators accountable by creating crimes of sex trafficking and labor trafficking in the state. We define sex trafficking as the receiving, recruiting, enticing, harboring, providing, or obtaining by any means an individual to aid in the prostitution of the individual. And we created a definition of the victim, of the sex trafficking victim. In 2008, the Advocates for Human Rights was able to do a needs assessment for the state of Minnesota, undertaken in part to explore why prosecutions weren't really falling into place at that point. And following that report, this legislature again took aggressive action to increase penalties and hold perpetrators accountable. Today, we do have prosecutions taking place in your county and in counties around the state. Thanks to that strong leadership, we've seen a sea change in law enforcement identification of sex trafficking victims, of really understanding that this is a crime with a victim. We know that strong offender accountability is one critical part of any coordinated community response to violence, and we know that victim safety is the other. And when enacting that 2005 legislation, the legislature recognized at that outset the need to protect victims of crime by authorizing the pilot project that's become the Runaway Intervention Project in Ramsey County. And I'm really pleased to say that that pilot project has actually been used as a pilot project to inform the results and the findings of the Safe Harbor report and the Safe Harbor implementation in the No Wrong Door report. In our 2008 needs assessment, we also identified several key recommendations that were needed to strengthen victim safety. One was creating protocols for identification of victims by service providers and law enforcement agencies. And the work in Ramsey County is instrumental in helping us build those protocols out. That has been spurred by this legislature's action around Safe Harbor. Greater access to housing and services tailored to meet the specific needs of trafficked persons was also top on the list of protection. And you're incredibly right, we need a place to put those kids, Representative. Ensuring that those who are defined as victims under Minnesota's sex trafficking law are not charged or prosecuted for their involvement in prostitution is also a critical part of that equation. In 2011, Safe Harbors Act, we took a significant step forward to achieving all of those key recommendations. So just to refresh, many of you were co-authors of that legislation, but it's been a couple of years and a few things have happened along the way in your lives between then and now. Why was Safe Harbors needed? Well, children found to be engaging in prostitution are simultaneously considered to be victims of sex trafficking, to be children in need of protection and services, to, in some cases, to be maltreated minors, and also to be juvenile delinquents. And we know that Minnesota's best practices had moved beyond simply adjudicating those victims of sexual exploitation as delinquent because of their actual engagement in prostitution. We know that by criminalizing the victim, we cause them further harm. We offer a weak and ineffective counteroffensive to what is a highly manipulative and sophisticated grooming and control process by traffickers. By treating the exploited children as victims of crime, we build their trust, and you can see that paying off in the Cozart case. We indicate to children they're not at fault for being the ones abused, for being the ones raped, for being the ones held captive and forced to have sex with 30 men in the course of a few days. We reduce victim contact with juvenile offenders, keeping them out of the juvenile justice system, eliminate stigmatizing records, we provide assistance. And remarkably, as demonstrated by the results of the Runaway Intervention Project, we set them on a path to recovery and to greater success. The cornerstone of 2011 Safe Harbor's proposal included two provisions that were really designed to work in tandem to eliminate the conflict that exists in Minnesota's law. First, eliminate the offense of engaging in prostitution from the definition of delinquency. And second, charging the Commissioner of Public Safety in consultation with Commissioners of Health and of Human Services and other stakeholders to develop a victim service model to address the needs of sexually exploited youth and youth at risk of sexual exploitation. The premise of these provisions was that both were necessary to effectively respond to the needs of sexually exploited youth. We early on recognized that simply decriminalizing prostitution without providing victims of the crime with appropriate, trauma-informed, victim-centered housing and services was not the answer. While working on the 2011 legislation, we heard loud and clear from law enforcement and service providers alike that absent the housing and services designed to address the needs of prostituted children, they'd be in even greater danger if we simply decriminalized. Manipulated by the traffickers, victims often view them as boyfriends. They quickly return to the perpetrators. They may be subject to violence or threats of violence against themselves or their families. And you heard on the tape the fear and the words that the girl spoke. He told me I owed him money, and he'd kill me if I didn't pay it back. These all interfere with the children's ability to simply voluntarily leave the trafficking situation and seek help. And the child protection system really lacks the capacity to step in where children face danger at the hands of strangers. Removing sexually exploited children from delinquency jurisdiction without replacing it with the ability to intervene would have left kids at risk of falling through the cracks. And the delayed implementation of the law into 2014 has given the Commissioner of Public Safety time to recommend the changes that professionals from around the state deem necessary to ensure that children will find safety and when leaving prostitution. Now, in 2011, the legislature considered in committee hearings, in this very committee, the fundamental premise of Safe Harbor that prostituted kids must be recognized as victims of sexual exploitation, not as delinquents. As passed, however, Safe Harbor fails to protect all children from being adjudicated delinquent from engaging in the crime of prostitution. And only young children, those under 16, are excluded from the delinquency definition. 16 and 17-year-olds can still be adjudicated delinquent for being the victims of a crime. Although the rationale for this change was never considered in committee or before the legislature, the distinction appears to rest on a misappropriation of the concept of the age of consent. Minnesota law doesn't actually define a legal standard for the age of consent. Rather, that term is loosely used to describe what the law identifies as strict criminal liability for perpetrators of rape and sexual assault in cases where the child is under the age of 16. The notion of the age of consent really relates to the criminal liability of the assailant, not to the child's ability to consent to have sex. Allowing the adjudication of 16 and 17-year-olds as delinquent for being trafficked and continuing to rely on the idea of consent at all when considering the prostitution of children is misguided. It perpetrates the false notion that it's a victimless crime, a victimless transaction between consenting parties in the face of the reality we know of its reality as a violent and predatory crime against kids. We support at the Advocates for Human Rights correcting that problem before the law goes into effect in 2014 by defining the term delinquent child to exclude children under 18 from being adjudicated as delinquent. Before I turn to Jeff Bauer, who is going to walk us through the No Wrong Door model, which the Advocates for Human Rights also is very supportive of seeing in its entirety, I want to commend the Department of Public Safety in particular Jeanette Biskovic at the Office of Justice Program for her leadership in convening a nearly 70-person group, working group, in a year-long process involving people from disciplines around the state and in jurisdictions around the state to come together to shepherd us through what has become the No Wrong Door approach that I think will propel us forward into a new era of child protection from human trafficking. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Mr. Bauer, do you want to go next?
Well, thank you very much, Chair Paymar and committee members. I never thought I'd say it's fun, but it's really fun to see so many of you. We worked so hard with 2 years ago to get this law passed. We thank you for that. It's been a real journey since then. So it was July 20th, 2011, when Governor Dayton signed the Safe Harbor Act into law. Those of us who were advocating so hard for that bill celebrated for about 30 seconds because we knew the work that we had ahead of us and the work that Ms. Garnett McKenzie and County Attorney Choi have described, which was before the law was to go into effect, we had to create the intervention model, this different model of where these sexually exploited children would go instead of into the juvenile justice system. And there were a few principles on the front end that we thought were really, really important, and they were these. The first is that we didn't want to duplicate resources. You know, sometimes the inclination when something like this comes up is we're going to build this whole brand new system, we're going to have all our own shelters, we're going to have all our own staff, it's going to be this great thing and we're going to solve this problem. We didn't want to do that, and in particular we didn't want to do that in a time when the state is facing a significant budget deficit and looking for efficiencies and good investments. And so utilizing existing structures like the currently existing homeless and runaway youth shelter system, those who already have that expertise, amongst other things, was really important to us. The second principle that we really thought was important was, again, building the capacity of existing organizations. There were discussions at the beginning of the process about if we were going to add shelter beds for sexually exploited youth, where would you add those? Should it be domestic violence shelters? Should it be battered women's shelters? Should it be homeless and runaway youth shelters? And what the best practices, not only in Minnesota, but around the country, say about that is it's most important to start with those who know how to work with vulnerable youth and build from there. And so when you think about the shelter and housing piece of this, think not of building a separate system, but really building the capacity of those who already know how to do this work, extra training, extra facilities to really take on this new population. The third principle that we had was to make systems work together better. That's been one of the most challenging parts about developing this model. And you know, you ever want to have a really interesting discussion, get a prosecutor, a public defender, a survivor, and an advocate to sit down at a table and agree on what the right model is for dealing with one of these kids. And we had those tough discussions for months and months. And because we knew, if you look at, so Minnesota was the fifth state to pass the Safe Harbor Law, so there was some history before we did this. New York State was the first in 2008. And New York State is a great cautionary tale about what can happen in these systems, which is New York State never had their prosecutors on board. And they passed it despite their prosecutors. And what has happened since then, not surprisingly, is their prosecutors have found a way around it. And the system doesn't work. And so what we did in Minnesota over the past year, and with Danette's leadership, who's here from the Department of Public Safety and others, is we had those tough conversations over the past year and worked out most of those, I don't want to say disagreements, differences of perspective, and got into a model that I think we all feel really good about, and a model that really does have the opportunity to work better than any ever has in the country, and I mean that sincerely. So if you look on page one of your No Wrong Door handout, I'm not going to go into great detail. You've got the detail with you, and I know you'll all look through it. I just want to highlight some of the key recommendations that have come out of this process. The first one that you'll see on the right-hand column, the very top, is the creation of a statewide director position. And the reason this is important, some of the comments today have alluded to, is we're trying to build a statewide system with regional hubs of services for youth. And so if you think about it, think about a northeast hub, northwest, southeast, southwest, and the metro area, and that system all working together. And to get to Representative Simon's point from earlier, you know, it's really, the coordination is really important because a lot of these children will ultimately need to be relocated to a place where they're maybe safer. And so we have to have a coordinated system where we can get a child from Bemidji down to Benson, or a child from Faribault, maybe up to Duluth, depending on what's going on. And so the statewide director position would be housed in the Department of Health. And the reasoning behind that is very much, you know, we fought for years to shift this issue from an issue of juvenile delinquents doing bad activities to a public health issue where children who are being victimized get the help and support and services they need. A lot like domestic violence had to be pushed into being a public health issue over all of those years that came before us. The second recommendation is the creation of what we're calling six regional navigators. And so these would be located in each of the regions that I mentioned. These would not be state employees. These would be grant-funded positions. And again, to get to one of our values was, if we would rather grant-fund a position within an existing organization who already knows how to do this work somewhere in Minnesota and expand what they know how to do instead of creating all this new infrastructure that we don't need. And so the regional navigators would be housed in existing organizations, and their job really is to connect the dots. And so if you have a juvenile trafficking victim in Thief River Falls, and that child needs shelter, that child needs medical attention, that child needs legal services, and all the other things we know these children need, it's the regional navigator's role to know how to connect the dots and to get that child connected to everything they need in their situation. The third recommendation that County Attorney Choi mentioned, and this is really, I see this as the engine that drives this whole operation, which is comprehensive training on juvenile sexual exploitation. One of the toughest things about these cases is identifying victims. And it's knowing the right questions to ask, and it's knowing how to relate to these children. The vast majority of the time when you encounter one of these children and you say, excuse me, are you a victim of sex trafficking? They have no idea what you're talking about. They don't know what that term is. They know that they're in a bad situation and they don't know how to get out. And unless the law enforcement professional or somebody else knows how to ask the right questions and investigate, it's really hard to identify victims sometimes. And a lot of the work County Attorney Choi's office is doing now by backlogging all of those previous runaway youth cases is to see if they can really identify patterns, communication, questions they should have asked, and develop protocol to better identify victims. So we want everyone in the state to know how to do that in law enforcement and other places. Number four, effective outreach to youth. Again, victims aren't often, hardly ever self-identifying. And so we need enough of an outreach presence to identify these victims. And again, not to belabor the point, but these would be grant-funded positions. They would be at existing organizations around the state to build their capacity to better serve this population and to reach out to more of this population. Number five, coordinated law enforcement investigations. It's the level of expertise and information on this issue is really diffuse around the state. A lot of times these kids have been brought through all kinds of different jurisdictions and communities on their journey of being trafficked. And so we do need to work on a system of better communication, better coordination of law enforcement investigation to build the strongest cases possible. And if you have more questions about that, I know County Attorney Choi would be glad to answer them at the end of this.
Excuse me one second, members. Can you turn off your cell phones? You have to power them off totally.
Thank you, Mr.
Testifiers also. Thank you. That's the, otherwise we can't hear you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number six, and this may appear a little bit confusing. So the No Wrong Door model that you see before you was based on the law as passed in 2011. And so when you look at number six, providing appropriate effective diversion opportunities for youth ages 16 and 17, that's because of the age distinction that exists in the Safe Harbor Law as written. And so that is important for a model to implement that law. That being said, the Family Partnership feels strongly, just as the Advocates for Human Rights, County Attorney Choi, and others, that we would really like to see that age distinction removed this session, preferably to really make this model be what it needs to be. So just a clarification about why this is written this way, based on the law as passed. Number seven, and I may turn this over to Ms. Garnett McKenzie for detail, but generally, this is what we were referring to in 260C, which allows a change that would allow for if a law enforcement officer finds a juvenile trafficking victim, and that juvenile trafficking victim's life, health, safety is in immediate danger, this would allow them, with, of course, the sign-off of the prosecutor's office, to hold that child for up to 72 hours in secure placement for that child's own health and safety until services and a safety plan can be put in place for that child. Number eight, this is really, really, really critical. And I'll tell you, not just from my travels around Minnesota over the last year, but from my discussions with folks across the country trying to build these kinds of systems, the access to safe and supportive housing, again, the model does not work without this. To have that first place that you bring that child when they are discovered, all the way through a transitional program, all the way through possibly specially trained foster family situation, of course, family reunification when possible. But without this, the model doesn't work. And when you even look at the homeless and runaway youth shelters as they exist in the state of Minnesota right now, they're not even coming close to meeting that need, not by a long shot. But even beyond that, right now in the whole state of Minnesota, the number of shelter beds dedicated specifically to juvenile sex trafficking victims in the whole state is two. Two beds in the whole state right now. And those are at Breaking Free right here in St. Paul. And I can't remember a time when they haven't been full with long, long waiting lists. And so we estimate that on any given night to make this model go, we're going to need between 35 and 40 on the low end additional beds across the state of Minnesota to serve juvenile sex trafficking victims. So that's why the budget ask on that is fairly significant. Number nine, appropriate, accessible, supportive services to sexually exploited youth. Again, this we're envisioning this to be a grant-funded program through the Department of Health. It's a whole range of comprehensive services, and you can see that in your packet. It runs the gamut from mental health counseling to chemical dependency treatment to legal advocacy. You know, we have the Pride program at my organization. We see 300 to 400 sex trafficking victims per year there. And one of the hardest things to deal with is these kids come in needing everything. They come in needing absolutely everything. And the level of trauma that they've suffered is, in the studies and in the research around it, no different than the post-traumatic stress disorder that victims of torture show when they go in for counseling. And so they need everything. I can't stress that enough. And so having a fund to fund those supportive services is critically important. Number 10, prevention. And this is something a whole number of members of our coalition hammered us very hard on, which is, we don't want to hear you use the language of ending sex trafficking in Minnesota unless you're going to talk about prevention. The best intervention model in the country is a wonderful thing, and we intend to build it. But unless we get at some of what we talked about earlier, which is preventing it in the first place, and a lot of that work happens with our boys and men in the state, we're not going to end sex trafficking in Minnesota. And so a real emphasis on that. And then last but not least, we want to know if this works and how it works, not only for Minnesota, but from our colleagues around the country who are, per usual, watching what Minnesota does before they decide what they're going to do. We need effective evaluation, we need to gather best practices, and we need to get those out to the rest of the country. And so those are the recommendations. It was a long, hard-fought process, but here is the report. This is where the responsibility of the Department of Public Safety, I know they're thankful for that, has ended, and this report has been handed off to advocates like us. To turn this into a bill and get some of you fine legislators to hopefully be our bill authors and move this forward in the next legislative session. And you have the budget in the back for the specific costs for these. I'm also glad to answer any questions you may have about that.
So where is the bill at this point? And is the governor's, is he recommending any additional housing funding in his budget, and is any additional housing funding in his budget, and where is this now? Because I'm sure it would come here eventually. But
absolutely, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. I've learned long ago not to speak for the governor, but what I will say is that he has been supportive on this issue. He was supportive in 2011. He remains supportive. These budget items did not appear in the governor's budget recommendations, nor did the $8 million increase that the homeless youth advocates were asking for. I think he would like to see this process, this go through the legislative process and for us to put a solid proposal together. I anticipate that he'll be supportive if we manage to get this to his desk. The bill itself, with the help of Ms. Perius and her colleagues in House Research, is being drafted as we speak through Representative Liebling's office. She will not be the chief author on the bill, but is allowing us to work through her office to get our bill language down. And we anticipate over the next 2 weeks or so to be having this discussion with a lot of you, putting the bill in front of you, getting your thoughts and ideas, and going forward with the strongest proposal we can.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Kiefer.
Mr. Chair. Why were the county attorneys in New York not supportive?
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer. Not everyone has county attorneys like County Attorney Choi and others in the state. And what I will say is a pervasive attitude amongst some prosecutors in the country who are not shy about telling us this at times is, these are bad kids who need to be punished. And I can't tell you why that is such a pervasive attitude. I think a lot of times it's just a lack of exposure to the actual experiences of the victims. I'm not sure how you can look at a 12-year-old girl who was forced in to being raped every day of her life and say that's because she's a bad kid. But, you know, oftentimes that is the perception of prosecutors, and again, let me clarify, fortunately not the vast majority of our prosecutors in Minnesota.
County Attorney Choi.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, if I can also address that, I think sometimes in law enforcement too, we want to have all the tools available to us. And sometimes I think we don't understand that sometimes the tool, by eliminating the tool, we can create a new tool, which is kind of a victim-centered approach. And so, some people in law enforcement will tell you that, well, it is, and it, in fact, in other types of situations, it's very useful to have the threat of prosecution over someone's head. But when you're dealing with a 15-year-old girl who is sexually exploited and probably believes that she's in love with the trafficker, it just doesn't work. And in fact, what we ought to be doing is just eliminating that whole option and just basically getting everybody focused on around the fact that it's no longer a crime, and what we need to do is we need to look at this 15-year-old girl as a victim of crime and start helping her. And then by helping her get strong and get on the right track, I think that response and that approach will get her to testify against the bad people.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiefer, I was on a television program last week with Representative Hackbarth, and the host of the program was Supreme Court Justice Barry Anderson, and he and I got into a conversation because he used to do defense work, and we talked about my work as a prosecutor, and he made the comment that in his years working as an attorney in this state and others and in the federal system, he remarked that Minnesota has, as a culture, the most highly ethical prosecutors he's ever seen. He said he didn't quite understand where that came from or why it was, but it's a culture, mm-hmm. and it develops over time, and of course you can lose it over time as well. But he remarked about how in Minnesota there will be prosecutors. He'll get comments and calls, say, by the way, I found this piece of evidence that your client would probably be interested in. In other states, you find that they'll actually lie just to win. And we are reminded as prosecutors that our top duty is to do justice. Number one, first and foremost. That is our top duty as prosecutors. As a defense attorney, your number one job is to represent your client, no matter what, almost anything, within the law that you can do. But as prosecutors, our job is to do justice. And I think that culture allows, there are, of course, are different county attorneys around the state that are different ends of that spectrum, of course. However, the culture allows someone like County Attorney Choi to actively engage in this, whereas I think in many other states you couldn't do it because you don't have the culture that enables it.
I have a question. I just read through this rather rapidly, but I just nowhere do I see it. I'm sure that your consortium or task force must have addressed it, but I don't see any information in here about immigrant girls who are women and who are trafficked, and some of the obstacles facing new Americans who are being trafficked, and just some of the issues in a lot of our communities where talking to law enforcement or the criminal justice system would be a taboo. Talking to your family would bring shame and ostracism, and so I'm wondering how that was addressed and how you're planning on addressing it.
Mr. Chair, one of the core values that underpins the entire report and the entire model going forward is that of culturally relevant, culturally appropriate services. Unfortunately, stigma and shame and ostracism apply beyond new immigrant communities when it comes to prostitution. And we've had conversations, I think, working, the Advocates for Human Rights works very closely with immigrant communities, and working with every individual community who'll say, there's trafficking in our community, but I don't want anybody to know because I don't want us to look like the bad people. We don't want to be that case of the Somali sex traffickers shown around over and over and over and bring that stigma to our community. And it's only us, right, that has this problem. So what the way that the model addresses this is through a core value of ensuring that we have appropriate services for the population being served, whether that is American Indian women and girls who have particular needs and particular vulnerabilities, particular issues around accessing law enforcement at the state and federal level, or immigrant women and girls who face potentially deportation of themselves or their parents if they bring a crime to light. So all of those things are built in without trying to target any one population within this report itself.
Okay. Are there any further questions before we adjourn? Mr. Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Prosecutor Choi, how far can you narrow down where this problem is? Can you get right down to zip codes? With this whole problem, or the actual cases at the geographical area, the percentages and where it's happening.
County Attorney Choi.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I think with the advent of the internet, where this all plays out, probably are going to be hotel rooms across the state of Minnesota, many of which are in suburban locations. But the issue of sex trafficking, prostitution, is no longer one of those situations where we see it in a street corner. From a geographic perspective, it's kind of spread out all over the place. And I can tell you from the standpoint of where the victims are coming from, I mean, they're coming from all over the state, and they're Minnesota children. With respect to the Johns, they're coming probably, you know, there's probably a profile that would be probably white middle class. Suburban, and the profile of the trafficker could be, you know, from anywhere. Just anybody who's engaged in criminal activity. I think people are realizing that human trafficking, sex trafficking, is actually pretty lucrative. And so I think you see a shift a little bit in some of the criminal enterprises that we're dealing with. And so there's probably some indicia of gang activity. But to say that prostitution, sex trafficking is happening in a specific geographic area, I think it's that's not really the case anymore. It's really all over the place, and it's happening throughout the state, and I would say across suburban hotel rooms.
Representative Cornish.
And the other question was, when you find a place for these victims, and they're really underage, do you run into problem with them being in the same facility with an older age like we do? And I hate to compare it to prisons because these are victims and not prisoners, but do you run into that problem sorting and then run into a problem where you can't commingle adults with the children and space problems? Would this have to be a specific youth facility, or could you mix?
I think it would be
County
more
Attorney
ideal
Choi.
Representative Cornish, I think it would be more ideal to have to take into account age. You know, for instance, in St. Paul, Breaking Free serves all women that have been prostituted, and that's the age range is very large. I also think that with respect to some of the youth that are being trafficked, typically they're going to be runaways, and as Jeff talked about, is to kind of figure out ways in which there are runaway shelters intervention social workers who are experienced in dealing with runaway kids to help them build the capacity around dealing with sexual exploitation is probably the best way to go. And there are some that do a wonderful job. I know the Bridge for Runaway Youth has developed a very good reputation.
Thank you.
So let me just close by saying I really appreciate the presentations and the update. I'm hoping that we can implement this proposal. I don't know that we can implement all of it this year, and I suspect that if there are resources, they are going to come from the Housing Committee, Department of Health and Human Services, maybe this committee. So we have some challenges ahead, but I really think that this is you're right on track. And we really appreciate all of your presentations, and to County Attorney Choi, your leadership in this area, and also for making those comments about prevention on the male side, Representative Lesh, too, because until we reduce demand, until men and boys start thinking differently that this is not a victimless crime and that they have this sense of entitlement to sexually exploit girls and women, the problem's not going to go away. And so with that, if there's no other comments, thank you again. This meeting's adjourned.